Substance. Stories about the stuff that shapes our world.
If you are looking at those salts at room temperature, they look pretty much like table salt. They are white. They do not feel differently. They flow like table salt. So it's pretty remarkable that just above the temperature of boiling water, they just melt. So I think that's pretty amazing.
Substance. It's easy to imagine table salt. It's one of the most familiar substances on the planet. If you've taken even one chemistry class, you may even know its molecular formula, NaCl, or sodium chloride. And if you're really paying attention that day, you might know that the sodium and the chloride are held together by what chemists call an ionic bond. But try to imagine table salt melting. And I don't mean like dissolving in water. I mean melting actual salt. Odds are you can't imagine that. That's because, like most salts, it melts at a really high temperature, 801 degrees Celsius. That's 1,473 degrees Fahrenheit. There's just no way that you are getting your stovetop hot enough for that. Of course, sodium chloride isn't the only salt out there. There are millions of other compounds out there held together by ionic bonds. And most, like table salt, stay solid until really high temperatures. But for some, when you mix them together in very special ways, you get a substance that melts at much, much lower temperatures. And that meltable, salty substance might just help our society move on from fossil fuels.
I have two small daughters. I want them to live in a world that is healthy and where they can live good lives. Of course, as an individual, it's not easy to do everything right. And in some cases, it costs a lot of money. But for example, we had to buy a car a couple of months ago, and we chose an electric car. We also try to reduce our energy needs at home. I think those steps are important on an individual level, and you can do a lot on yourself. But then also, of course, it needs bigger players like BASF, like other chemical companies or other companies in general. And I hope that this is happening. And I hope that with our products, we can enable that as well. That's basically what I like about my job.
Substance.
I'm Niels Born. I'm a global marketing and product manager for the nitrogen salts, which is part of the inorganics portfolio at BASF. I'm in BASF now for 9 years, started in research like a lot of chemists do in the company, and moved into the business after that. I think many problems we face have solutions in material science, like batteries, solar cells, chips. Everything is basically connected to inorganic chemistry and material science. And during my studies in university, I realized that I might have the biggest impact in solving problems by going into inorganic chemistry.
Inorganic compounds are basically any compounds that aren't made mostly of carbon and hydrogen. Sugar is organic. Table salt is inorganic. Nitrogen salts are exactly what they sound like, salts that contain nitrogen. Most of them are pretty simple, and they have names like sodium nitrate and ammonium chloride and ammonium nitrate. You don't necessarily have to remember that. What they're called is less important than their material properties, which turn out to be pretty amazing and useful in some cases. For some kinds of nitrogen salts, when you mix two or more together, the melting point of the mixture drops dramatically. So low that scientists actually call them molten salts because they're so easy to melt. Niels says that molten salts, simple as they may seem, are actually one of the most exciting chemical technologies for a fossil fuel-free future.
So the melting point is actually not far above the cooking temperature of water, like 150 degrees, basically between 150 and 300 degrees. And these mixtures are stable until a temperature of 500 to 600 degrees. So this window of operation between 150 and 500, 600 degrees, is optimal for steam generation. And that's the reason why you can use those salt mixtures, those so-called molten salts, for exactly that application.
Figuring out how to produce steam without also producing greenhouse gases is one of the most intractable and also invisible challenges in the fight against climate change. That's because we use steam to produce heat, and our society needs a lot of heat. Globally, nearly half of energy consumption and a third of all carbon emissions go into just heating things up. Those unassuming molten salts Neil's just described, they're helping to change that. I'm Joe Hansen, and this is Substance, a podcast about the discoveries and innovations in chemistry and beyond, helping us build a sustainable society for the future. In short, we tell stories about stuff that shapes our world. This time, we're taking a look at heat and salt. No, I'm not talking about cooking. Well, not just cooking. I'm talking about cooking and our homes and our factories and just about every process that we humans use to create the world we live in.
You know, for the coffee you drink this morning, you actually consumed heat, and that's what you needed, whether it was gas or whether it was electricity in the stove, but you needed that in the cup that holds the coffee to make it. You actually use a lot of heat. For the clothes you had to dry them at some point. So literally all of the different steps that you can imagine in a simple daily life, they are actually surrounded by heat to a great extent. To make sure that we decarbonize and we do anything meaningful, we certainly need to target and tackle the problem in relation to heat and decarbonization of that. And we need to be serious with that.
This is Sylvia Trevisan, assistant professor at the KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden.
Specifically, what my research does, it's to look into thermal technologies for industrial decarbonization.
Sylvia is a mechanical engineer, and it seems like she was almost born with that job.
I think I had, from the very beginning, a very engineering mindset. Like, as a kid, for example, in kindergarten or so, when they asked me to draw my house, I would draw the blueprint of the house rather than the typical housing as kids would do.
Nowadays, Sylvia's research group focuses on understanding how to generate and store heat without also generating CO2. They look at everything from how to optimize the individual parts of heaters that don't rely on fossil fuels to understanding which systems work best for different businesses and industries. The problem of heat doesn't get nearly as much attention as flashier technologies for producing electricity, but that actually fueled Sylvia's interest in it when she was a university student in her hometown of Genoa, Italy.
And then at some point, I remember, I think it was maybe the second year or so of the studies in universities, and we had this very great professor that was teaching heat-related things, and then he started explaining how heat is actually maybe not really perceived in life. So we always see electricity, maybe that's what we are used to, but it's actually needed for pretty much anything that we do and everything that we consume in our life. It was really like a bit of an eye-opening moment. You realize that, well, I always been thinking about energy in a certain way, but I realized that I'm missing out a lot. So I always been thinking about energy in the sense of electricity. I'm actually really missing a big part of it, actually a huge part of it. I guess maybe more personally speaking, I'm always been very much for the supporter of the underdog type of thing and the no flashy, as you said, thing and so on. So I like also the fact that it wasn't as popular or not as fancy in a way.
When most people think about the technologies for the energy transition, they think about technologies that produce electricity, like solar energy and wind energy, or technologies that use electricity, like electric cars and buses. It turns out we use way more fossil fuels to produce heat, whether it's to heat our homes or power our traditional factories. In the case of factories, nearly 90% of the heat that they use comes from fossil fuels. Replacing heaters that use fossil fuels with heaters that rely on electricity to produce heat has the potential for far more CO2 savings than an individual switching over to an electric car.
So, of course, this all starts from the assumption that we need to produce as much electrical energy as possible from renewables. And then if we can use that to actually power factories, for example, that need heat, or even our own buildings for the heating system, which normally, as of today, are fueled by some kind of fossil fuels, then we can remove a lot of that fossil fuel from the energy system and then save CO2, generally speaking. If we manage to shift at least a big amount of this heat, well, we can largely decarbonize half of the energy consumption that we have worldwide. So, of course, this is a massive potential impact.
Sylvia says completely transforming the energy system so that every home and every company gets all of their heat from electricity will take a lot of time, effort, and raising awareness of new options that are out there. It's one thing convincing a single homeowner to install a heat pump rather than their own gas boiler. That might be rather easy to do. But the scale at which we are talking about is completely different.
Let's say if you are a brewery, if you do have a natural gas boiler on site, you typically just turn it off, turn it on, and that's it. You know how long it takes to warm it up in the morning, let's say, when you start your shifts. And then you will start a bit before just to allow for it. And then you run it, you can easily control it, and all of your operators know how to do it, and that's easy.
The ease of that old fossil fuel-based heating system poses a major challenge. Let's say that brewery wanted to switch to some kind of electric heater. In addition to buying a whole new system, they also have to learn how to use it and figure out how it fits into their normal beer brewing process. The more complicated their process, the harder that might be. And if they want to use only renewable energy, say solar energy, they still need a way to brew beer when the sun isn't shining. So they need some way to store the solar energy so that it can be used when they need it. That adds even more complexity, which might make an electric system even harder to use. So hard that it might not be worth it for that brewery to replace their gas boiler. To solve this, a new kind of company is emerging, one that provides the heat in the same way that a gas company might provide the gas to run the boiler. Instead of selling gas at a set price, those companies sell heat at a set price. They maintain the complex equipment that produces the heat, so the brewery owner can just flick a switch and heat their brewing vats just like they can today. Those companies are providing what's known in the energy industry as heat as a service. Sylvia says to decarbonize industries from beer brewing to textile manufacturing to chemical production, manufacturers will have to be open to becoming a new kind of customer.
It's more of a matter of finding the first customers or the right people, the right companies that have the strong willingness to actually make an impact in their own process and try out this equipment, let's say, and then show how they can work to the rest of the world.
Sylvia says that moving toward electrified heat generation will also help companies stay competitive as regulations change. It also may make companies more able to weather changes in fossil fuel prices.
You can strongly delink yourself and decouple from typical fuel supply and typical costs associated with that. So you are much more resilient, let's say, in your own facility, in your own network. So you can decouple from, you know, external gas supply or oil supply and the whole cost and the whole instability, globally speaking, associated with that. I don't think the big barrier is technical per se. You know, there are technical solutions. It's maybe just a matter of pushing them a little bit further in terms of development, but there are solutions. So I think we are in a transition phase in which technology is pretty much there. It's more the surroundings, let's say, that needs to get ready for it.
It turns out that some of the most advanced technologies for providing fossil fuel-free heat rely on molten salts. In fact, if you think of molten salts as a kind of technology in and of themselves, they're actually kind of old. Batteries that rely on molten salts to store energy are about as old as nuclear reactors. In a more modern context, they're already deployed on a massive scale as a way to replace fossil fuels in producing electricity.
Substance.
Molten salt has been used over the last 20, 25 years a lot in the context of concentrating solar power plants.
Concentrating solar power plants, or CSPs, are power plants that rely on the energy of the sun but they don't use photovoltaic solar panels that convert sunlight directly into electricity. Instead, they use big mirrors to concentrate the heat from the sun, store it, then release it as electrical energy.
This heat in the vast majority of these plants is actually captured by molten salts and stored in molten salts. So we have this power plant which have massive molten salt storage. By massive, I am speaking about huge tanks which are maybe 15 meters in diameter, 15 meters tall. So it's like a big building full of molten salts. So that's where they get most of the, let's say, maturity from a technology perspective.
Molten salts are perfect for CSPs, not only because they melt at low temperatures, but because they can hold a lot of heat and store it until it's needed. Today, there are CSPs in operation all over the world in places where there is a lot of sun. Saudi Arabia, China, Morocco, Spain, the United States. But as photovoltaics have become inexpensive, there is less of a drive to build these huge city-scale power plants when solar panels can directly convert power to electricity. What solar panels can't do, though, is store that energy. Because of this, a new purpose for molten salts has emerged, one that takes advantage of the fact that they can store and produce heat.
There is a lot of research, I would say, on different aspects, from materials to subcomponent to full system integration when it comes to molten salts. And yeah, the main scope, generally speaking, and to support this transition from large-scale solar plants and all of the industrial experience with that toward new sort of application in the context of industrial decarbonization.
To aid decarbonization, molten salts are being integrated into systems that can convert electrical power into heat, store it, and release that heat whenever it's needed. Companies that want to provide heat as a service are developing new systems that are smaller and more adaptable to industrial heating needs.
In principle, it's just electric heater, storage, and discharge unit, heat exchanger. When you charge the system, what you do is that you get the cold salts from the tank, you pass them through the electric heater, the charging unit, you get hot salts, and then this goes back into the tank. And so there is more hot salts into the tanks, and it's more charged.
And when you want to discharge them, you take the hot salts from the tanks, pass them through the discharging unit, your heat exchanger, and you've produced steam. You cool down the salts and put them back into the tank. To support this transition, researchers are developing new technologies like super efficient heat pumps to heat the salts and heat exchangers to extract that heat and produce steam. People are also studying new molten salt mixtures with better properties for steam generation. One company that's working to provide heat as a service and relies on technologies that use molten salts is the Norwegian Kyoto Group. Sylvia started working with Kyoto during her doctoral research, supporting their early stage work developing molten salt systems that could be used to store heat and discharge heat. Her lab still works with Kyoto to help them to further optimize their thermal energy storage systems.
Testing here in the lab, we are working with them in a molten salt rig in which we can test different type of subcomponents and the risk, all of that prior to their installation in the real facilities. But we are working with them also in a broader perspective in terms of understanding how their installation fits into different kind of industrial sectors, how to upscale, downscale it, and so forth.
In 2023, Kyoto opened a pilot project in Aalborg, Denmark, designed to provide steam for the city's municipal district heating system.
The unit itself, it's connected to the district heating network, the city. So when they operate it, they can provide heat to the buildings in the city and provide relatively low temperature steam to do that.
This fall, Sylvia, along with researchers in her group and those from Kyoto, published a study that looked at the performance of the system, which they call the Heat Cube, over the last 2 years.
Then the key things that we highlighted in that work with them was, for example, the high efficiency of the system. So we're speaking of efficiencies higher than 93-94% between using the electric power and then delivering the heat, which is in general extremely high in the context of even a pilot facility that is, of course, not super optimized
That means that about 94% of the electrical energy that goes into the heating system comes out as heat. Only about 6% is wasted. That efficiency is already on par with state-of-the-art boilers that rely on fossil fuels, but relying on electric heaters has the potential to push efficiencies much higher, even higher than 100%. Yes, you heard that right. Electric heat pumps can actually produce more heat energy than the energy of the electricity that they take in. That's because the electric energy that goes into a heat pump isn't itself doing the heating. It just powers the heat pump, which then concentrates heat from the air or the ground.
A big part of the research that we are doing right now is to understand if and how very high temperature heat pumps could be used to support the electric heaters. So typically in those machines, you can have efficiencies when we are speaking of these high temperatures, maybe in the order of magnitude of 150%. So we get certain electricity in and we get much more heat out of it.
Systems that use heat pumps aren't up and running yet. But Sylvia says the molten salt heater in Aalborg also demonstrated something nearly as important as efficiency, flexibility.
The other big things that we highlighted in there were about the flexibility in general of the system. So if you have a facility that is meant to use power, store it in the form of heat, and then deliver it to the industrial client, what is extremely important is that you can, at any given time, make sure that you can provide the heat to the industrial client. And we demonstrated by a bunch of different testing and data in these works that the system as it is today can actually respond this rapidly, also in the charging side. And we are speaking of response time in the order of a few seconds, literally. So it can really cope with any sort of renewable fluctuating production and really support the grid in doing that and in absorbing more renewables. It also opened up a lot of revenues potential because they can sell all of these services also to the grid operator and then make sure that, you know, they can also get money and be paid not just for the heat they produce to the end user, but also for these supporting services, let's say, that they provide to the grid operators.
One of the major challenges with renewables like wind and solar is they only produce power intermittently. By storing heat as molten salt and making it flexibly available, systems like the Heatcube provide the electric grid a place to store all that excess electricity when there's a lot of it, and serve as a backup to the grid in case the sun's not shining or the wind's not blowing.
I think, generally speaking, from a society perspective, it's extremely important that companies like Kyoto, of course, have its own learning, its own pilot also to show to people and so on. But it's also very good from a society perspective that all of the learnings, we can translate them in a way that other people, maybe other company, can also at least partially take from them, leverage them, and apply them to their system. The market for industrial decarbonization, particularly in this medium temperature heat stage, it's huge. And it's largely untapped as of today. And there are a number of companies, of course, going in there, but I think if you ask anybody involved in the field, they will never tell you that there is big competitions in there. Rather, the winning of somebody is actually a great step forward for the overall market. So in that sense, it's just good to use as much as possible, share as much as possible learnings and experiences.
Sylvia says that Kyoto is most advanced when it comes to molten salt-based heating and storage. But there are other companies out there trying to do the same things. There are also companies that use other materials like sand or bricks to store the heat and air to transfer it to steam generators. Some of these companies are already working with commercial partners. Still, Sylvia says there is room for everyone.
At this stage, even if there was a winning technology, that winning technology would not have the ability to manufacture it at the scale and the rapidity that we actually need. With that said, I strongly believe that there is not really a winning technology, rather different competitive solutions actually have advantages and disadvantages, I'd say, and can fit better with certain type of requirements from the industrial side, with certain type of temperatures, with certain types of flexibility needs, certain types of integration into the overall industrial facility, whereas others can fit more into other systems. And I think all of these companies agree that it's not really a major competition. Both because, as I said, the market is huge, because a big barrier, it's also lack of awareness from the end users and from the public in general. We need to come together through what devs and through what installing more of this.
Kyoto itself has already moved past the pilot phase, and recently its first commercial heat cube started operation at KALL Ingredients, a food manufacturing plant in Hungary. The molten salt for that heat cube? It came from BASF.
For BASF, there's basically two reasons you want to be involved in that technology. One is we a heat user. We have heat demand in different sites, especially in smaller sites. This could be a use case for BASF. So it's very important for us to observe this technology and look into it, especially because it's also very easily combinable with renewable energy, which BASF is also now building in some sites. But then on the other hand, of course, we are also a salt supplier and we have an interest in this technology as a salt supplier.
There are basically two ways to make nitrogen salts that can be used in molten salt-based thermal batteries. They can be mined from the few places in the world where these salts occur naturally, but that comes with an environmental cost. It also comes with a practical one. There are just a lot of impurities in the naturally occurring salts that can destroy the properties that make them so useful for storing and transferring heat. BASF produces its salts in factories without the need to mine anything. Neil says that's why companies like Kyoto trust BASF to provide the quality of salts that they need for their systems to work effectively.
So I think two things. One, we are the synthetic salt producer, which basically gives us a better starting point because our salt is just principally better in quality. And then we also have the quality control and all the processes that a large company like BASF is giving us. Yeah. And we also are back integrated. We do not rely on any raw material from outside of BASF.
That ensures the heat cube at KALL Ingredients in Hungary will be long-lasting and perform as it's expected. That reliability is key for any company that wants to free its heat supply from fossil fuels.
KALL is basically doing exactly that. They are decarbonizing their heat supply. And what they want is to have a reliable heat supply at a low cost. And what they manage there is to, by implementing this heat cube, get a heat supply at a price that is competitive to a gas-generated heat supply. And by that, they are competitively substituting a fossil-sourced heat supply.
How soon other companies will follow suit is still unclear, but change is coming.
It's not easy to really put a number on it, but I would say there is a large demand for decarbonized steam. I mean, there's a push from politics and also from society to decarbonize basically everything. And steam is one large generator of carbon emissions. And so this technology enables that. So I would think that in the next 10 or 15 years, this will gather quite a high importance in that field. It's always a little tricky to say, okay, this is going to happen in the next 3 years or in the next 5 years. But we are seeing definitely traction there and a lot of projects now in the planning phase and will come into fruition over the next 5 years.
So I believe over the next few years, 5 years or so, we'll see more and more. And probably also all from the industrial end user side, they will be much more aware of this and much more willing to go into that and shift toward this. So it's happening, it's out there. All of this is moving fast. It needs some kind of direction. It needs experience in doing that. But I strongly believe that over the next 5 years or so, we will see a massive transition to start. And then, you know, once the ball starts rolling, then more and more will actually jump onto it, I think.
We've known about the promise of molten salts for decades. The technological advancements needed to harness that promise are already here. Change is already happening. The path to a sustainable future may travel over complex terrain, but not all of the tools we need to chart it are complicated. Sometimes we just need people who are willing to pick them up and march on ahead. How to effectively decarbonize heat may have once looked like an insurmountable obstacle, but today we are closer than ever to leaving it in the dust. Next time on Substance, fibers. Join us on our next episode as we dig into that and more. This has been Substance, stories about the stuff that shapes our world. Substance is a podcast by BASF, produced by Territory Agency, in collaboration with Wake Word and me, Joe Hansen. Research and scripting by Danielle Sedbrook, Claudia Doyle, Hardy Rode, and Joe Hansen.